Welcome to the latest episode of Your Wealth with Gemma Dell, a podcast series designed to help you create, grow, and protect your wealth.
Hi, and welcome to Your Wealth. I'm Gemma Dell, NAB Trades Director of SMSF and Investor Behaviour. This time last year, our guest today joined me to discuss the Australian dollar and forecast the likely changes for 2018. What is lovely about that is that his predictions were surprisingly accurate, the greatest challenge you can imagine for currency. That guest is Ray Attrill, the Head of Foreign Exchange Strategy for NAB, and he's here today. Thanks so much for joining me, Ray.
My pleasure. Good to be here again.
Particularly on the back of what you said last time, right? That was very impressive. Can you tell us a bit about what your forecast was?
Well, it was almost a year ago, wasn't it?
Exactly.
Was it February? It was February 2018. And I'm not sure if I had breakfast. I can't remember if I had breakfast. So what I said a year ago, I really, I'll have to think back in the memory banks, but I think what we were saying then, the Aussie was around 78 cents against the US dollar. And at that time, we were forecasting a fall down to sort of the mid-70s or a little bit lower over the course of the year. Now, we subsequently revised that thinking around mid-year to actually say we thought the currency could end the year closer to 70 cents, 71 cents was our point forecast, which is pretty much where we did end the year. So it would be nice to have picked that right at the beginning of the year, but we got there in the end. And the big drive, so that decline that, as I say, we had been expecting for some time, and the big drivers of that, if I look back, were lower commodity prices, particularly for industrial metals, things like aluminium, for example. Also oil prices, and that's increasingly important for the Aussie dollar because LNG, which is becoming one of the biggest export commodities for Australia, are priced directly off the spot price of oil. Yeah. So sharply up, lower oil prices has a read through to the Aussie dollar. And we also had a big deterioration in risk sentiment, particularly in emerging markets back in April, which really started weighing on the currency. And then later in the year, from October onwards, we saw the US stock market falling sharply and dragging sort of developed markets generally down with it. And that's that's proving to be a big driver of sentiment towards the currency. So those were the big things, rather than the changes that we saw in interest rates. So yes, the US raised interest rates, four times over the course of 2018. So that differential between US interest rates and Australian interest rates continued to widen to the detriment of the Australian dollar, but in the scheme of things, didn't actually have as big an impact as some of those, the weakness that we saw in commodity prices and risk sentiment.
I find that comment you make about the interest rate differential really fascinating because I remember then, this is an extremely long time ago, but at one point the Aussie was, you may not have even been in Australia at the time. The $2 Australian to the US dollar, right? It was ridiculous. And there was always a comment that if at any point Australian interest rates were below US interest rates, the dollar would fall to like 20 cents or something ridiculous. And yet we find ourselves in a scenario where interest rates are rising in the US, they're not rising in Australia, and yet everyone's just fine.
That's right. It was 1998, to be and you're right, and it was before I landed on these shores. I'm still trying to kick the habit of the English accent.
But beautiful.
And fast forward 3 years after, it actually took over 2 years from the time that those interest rates actually flipped from being more advantageous to the US before the currency actually fell sharply, and we ended up with 48 cents was the low against the US dollar. So there's been a lot of, in the last year or two, saying, well, that crossover interest rates is likely to happen. Looking back to what happened at the end of the last century, if you like. And we've been saying, look, things are very different now to then, in particular, the level of commodity prices in Australia, very much higher today than it was back then. Back in the late 90s was the dot-com boom. Everybody wanted a piece of the US action. So there were massive capital flows going into the US, which was driving the US dollar up. So the interest rates are important, but they're not the be-all and end-all, as I'm sure we'll talk about a little more shortly. So that's why we're saying, even with those rate differentials today, where they were back then, it's not reason to think that the Aussie dollar is going to go to 50 cents. Famous last words, I hope not.
Always brave in your industry. So what are your thoughts? The currency's ended up almost exactly where you expected it to, for the reasons you expected it to fall, which is pretty excellent. And the last time we spoke, you had said, we predicted this, and we predict it for these reasons. All the reasons happened, but the thing didn't happen. The outcome was different. Whereas this time, it's quite the opposite. All of the drivers have fallen into place. Currency is where you expect it to be. What are your thoughts about where it is now and why it's in that position?
Well, if I reference what we call our fair value model, one of the ways that we try and put a little bit of science around what is ultimately, I suppose, is an art in terms of trying to pin the tail on the donkey when it comes to currencies. The models that we like to use is give us a bit of a framework, incorporate interest rate differentials between Australia and the rest of the world, commodity prices, and most relevant to Australia, and perhaps the most unpredictable, is the state of risk sentiment. Okay? So the Aussie dollar has consistently proved itself to be a very risk-sensitive currency. Yeah. But if I look at where the juxtaposition of all those three factors at the moment, they're telling us the Aussie should be somewhere between 71 and 72 cents, which is exactly where it is. So you can say, well, nothing to see here.
But obviously, you did ask we should timestamp this, right? So we'll date stamp this as 22nd of February, which is a Friday, just in case something ridiculous happens over the weekend. Very important we say it's the 22nd of February.
No, I think it is. By the time folks listen to this, there's quite a lot of globally significant events that I think are going to unfold in the coming weeks. So do bear that in mind. But if I look at the next few months, at least, in terms of what our outlook is, I think we are going to have some strongly competing influences on the currency. One of them is going to be the fate of US-China trade relations. Another one is going to be Brexit, both of which we actually think could resolve in quite a positive way as far as how they play into risk sentiment. We can come to that again in a moment. But on the downside, we're also the impending federal elections coming onto the radar now. Historically, elections haven't had much bearing on volatility in currencies here. But if I look across the world, where we have seen changes of the colour of governments, they have had some influence. Most recently, in New Zealand, for example, in 2017. So we're worried that the prospect of a change in government, which is clearly what the polls are suggesting, is likely, could be a source of concern, I think, particularly to some foreign investors, so it could act as a weight on the currency. So at the moment we're saying, between now and the middle of this year, we think the risks are that the Aussie could go down and revisit that sort of 70 level. Remember, we've been down as low as 67 cents on January the 3rd when we had this so-called flash crash. So I think there are some downside risks from domestic factors. But if I then go beyond the middle of the year, and in the second half of the year, we've actually got the Aussie dollar coming back up to closer to 75 cents, okay? But a lot of things are going to have to fall into place for that forecast to be near accurate. And in particular, I think we're going to need to see evidence that the global economy is in much better health than it seems to be at the moment, in Europe in particular, okay? And I think in turn, if we do see signs of that, then that is going to play positively into risk sentiment and how that plays out for equity markets, for example, which, if it does, I think would be a source of support for the Aussie dollar. But more importantly, it's also something that we think will bring about a more sustained decline in the US dollar, because most of the thinking and the conversation that we might have about the Aussie dollar is sort of 90% made in the USA. So, to some extent, for all the science that we try and wrap around a method of thinking about a forecast in the currency, by and large, it's about getting the big dollar right, as we say. And our sense is that the US dollar is on borrowed time here, particularly with signs that, certainly for the next 6 months or so, the Federal Reserve, the US Central Bank, is probably done with raising interest rates. And there are a lot of secular and structural forces that we think are going to come to bear down on the US dollar in the next sort of 6 months to 2 to 3 years, for example. So our call is that the US dollar is going to be weaker later in the year than it is at the moment. And the flip side of that is that we think the Aussie will come back to life and, as I say, head back up at least into the mid-70s, we think, by year end.
That is very interesting. So what are your thoughts about... So your current status is that effectively US dollar is a bit overpriced.
Yes.
And overpriced due to what, an assumption that interest rates will continue to increase there?
No, I mean, our view is
economic weakness?
We can look at sort of what we call valuations and say, well, what is, there are things called the Big Mac Index, for example. What does it cost me to buy a Big Mac in Tokyo versus a Big Mac in New York?
That in
what
print?
Exchange rate between the dollar and the yen, for example, would mean that, whether I'm if I'm a US citizen buying a Big Mac in Tokyo, it costs me the same amount of US dollars than it does, if I buy it on home territory. Now, that's a very simplified way of talking about fundamental valuation, and we can extrapolate that. to the whole range of goods and services that, that might be in the typical shopping basket, for example, something we call purchasing power parity. If I look at that, or I look at a more elaborate way of saying that is real exchange rates, so actual exchange rates adjusted for the changes in price levels and inflation in different countries, that's telling us that the US dollar is at least 10% overvalued.
Yeah, right, okay.
So that's one of the factors that figures in our sort of medium-term thinking about whether the a particular currency is overpriced or undervalued. That's one thing. And the other thing that's been worrying us really since sort of Donald Trump got his tax plans through Congress in 2000 and was it early 2018, late 2017, that is guaranteeing that the US budget deficits are going to be are on a fairly explosive path. And historically, if we look at, you know, whether US budget deficits, what we call the twin deficits, which also incorporates the trade deficit for the rest of the world, which is very large in the US, obviously. If we look at that in relation to how that tends to play out for currencies, when those deficits are getting bigger, as they are mandated to do under current US tax law that's been approved, historically, and with something of a lag, that tends to be a weight on the dollar. So think of foreign investors being asked to stump up, ever more sort of ever more enthusiasm, if you like, for buying US dollar assets. And at some point they say, well, if I'm going to buy $500 billion more of US government bonds next year than I did this year, I need some incentive to do that. And one of those incentives might be higher interest rates, but the other might be, well, give me a discount on the price, which is the exchange rate. Right? So if the US dollar falls against the euro or the Aussie dollar, then it's actually, I can buy more treasury bonds for my money, if you like. And so, so it may well be that the US dollar has to weaken in order to attract the level of capital inflows coming from the rest of the world. Okay. So that's sort of, we're calling that a secular force, the so-called twin deficits. And, for the last 12 to 18 months, it hasn't really come to bear. The US dollar has continued to attract the foreign capital as necessary, and the currency relatively stable, and that's largely a function of the superior economic performance by the US than much of the rest of the world. But that dynamic could be in the process of shifting. We start to see the rest of the world doing better, for example. Foreign investors may just be a little bit more reticent to buy US financial assets with the alacrity that they have done. I think that's a recipe for a weaker dollar.
That's fascinating. That's going to be really interesting to see how that plays out, because the other factor that you've mentioned is the US-China trade tensions. Some of the biggest buyers of US treasuries have been the Chinese. How do those factors play out together? What are your thoughts on it?
Well, the China-US trade dispute is front and centre and has been really since the middle of last year when, when Trump first put those tariffs at, he's been pretty active there and having some big impact, which makes life for a humble economist pretty difficult because you're trying to predict the unpredictable.
You've got to follow Twitter and the
absolutely.
Data.
Absolutely. I have it's special authority within the National Storm. I'm one of the very few people who's allowed to have Twitter on my my NAB mobile phone, for example, because I can't do my job without it, right? So
bless.
I have special dispensation.
That was not something that you would have predicted 5 years ago.
Absolutely. No, that I would be formally requesting the right to have Twitter so that I can follow the president of the free world. But there you go. The trade dispute has clearly had an impact. It's clearly had a very unsettling effect on emerging markets from the middle of last year. And as I said, and that has been a big factor that has weighed on the Australian dollar. What is continually being demonstrated is that when emerging markets are under periods of stress, as they were from sort of April, May last year, we can almost date the decline in the Aussie from near that sort of 78 cent level down to sort of 73, 74, almost to the day that emerging markets started selling off relative to the US stock market and developed markets. So, if you go back to April, the US stock market was roaring ahead. All of a sudden, the prospect of the China trade war became very real. Emerging markets started selling off, and the Aussie dollar, started going with that. So essentially, global investors are looking at they're seeing the close trade links between Australia and emerging markets, in particular, obviously China. There's a lot of liquidity available in the Australian dollar that's not available in other currencies and other asset markets. And so it almost becomes sort of self-fulfilling that when emerging markets sell off, a lot of traders will rush and sell the Australian dollar as a hedge, if you like, saying, well, if emerging markets or China are going to go through some kind of a correction, but the chances are Australia will suffer and the Aussie dollar will go down, so we can, you know, get in and out of the Australian dollar very, very quickly. So that's really important. So that's why the China trade dispute and how that resolves is going to be really important. Our take is that we're pretty optimistic that at some stage in the next, you know, weeks or, you know, or a matter of a few months at most, China and the US will strike some sort of a bargain. We had reports just this last week that you know, some sort of memorandum of understanding is being cobbled together to cover all range of things that are sources of angst for the US, ranging from intellectual property to forced technology transfer, etc. Not just, you know, you will buy more soybeans and corn and whatever else it is that we're committing to buy. And I think what's changed in the last couple of months is that Donald Trump had been touting for weeks and weeks, look at our stock market, look at the value of your 401k, which is the equivalent of our superannuation funds, and look how well it's doing, and look how badly China is doing. This proves that my, you know, my tough stance on trade is really working. Mm. Fast forward 3 months and the US stock market's fallen 20%. And all of a sudden that narrative has worn extremely thin, hasn't it? And you know, the reports are Donald Trump turns to his advisors and says, what do I need to do to get the stock market back up? And, you know, and then they say to him, well, actually sorting out your trade fight with China would be one bit of necessary condition, not a sufficient condition perhaps, but a necessary condition.
You're not personally in charge of the stock market, but so I think the US playing brinkmanship with the Chinese is probably not a good way to help it.
So I think that Trump is now very incentivized, whereas perhaps he wasn't 3 months ago, to do a deal. So I think that that's really significant. And clearly the Chinese economy has been weakening for reasons other than the trade dispute. But I think, so again, from China's point of view, you know, trying to put this trade dispute behind them, I think, again, is a necessary, if not a sufficient condition to get the Chinese economy back up. So I think both sides here are very incentivized to get a deal, and I think, you know, there will be some kind of a deal struck between Presidents Trump and Xi in the coming weeks. You know, and this may not be the all singing, all dancing resolution, and China's not going to agree to dismantle its sort of, you know, the way that it manages its economy in terms of a very sort of, you know, centrally planned, you know, orchestrated economy, in sharp contrast to the US, if you like, but I think enough, you know, enough concessions are going to be made that I think will satisfy the US for the time being, and that's going to be hugely positive, not just for sort of sentiment towards China, but I think emerging markets generally. So that again feeds into our Aussie dollar view, which is to say for a more positive risk backdrop in the sort of second half of the year, I think, than we've been experiencing the last 3 or 4 months of this.
So with that in mind, my next question was going to be that this slowdown in China is getting a lot of attention. And if I look at the NAB trade base, the sell-off in Blackmores was a big shock to our investors. They're following AT Milk. Very, very finely tuned attention on what's happening in China. The domestic demand story as it relates to the Australian stock market, but just more broadly, and the impact on Australia and things to be aware of. Thoughts on that? You've mentioned how it's related to the trade tensions, but more broadly, the impact on Australia?
Well, the thing that's really sprung up just in the last few days have been the reports that that China may be impeding the import of coal to Australia, which has created quite a lot of volatility in the currency at the back end of last week. We're heading back down towards that 70 cent level. There's a lot of uncertainty about exactly what the motives are for that, but obviously there is a suggestion there, or certainly a whiff of concern, that this actually represents retaliatory action by China against Australia's decision to ban Huawei from involvement in the construction of the 5G network in Australia, as other so-called Five Eyes nations, so it includes the likes of Canada, the US, New Zealand, etc. So this is China really flexing its muscles, saying that if you're going to do things that we think damage our corporate interests, then you know, we can make life pretty difficult for you. Now, coal is not the be-all and end-all. The amount of, you know, if Australia at the end of the day is not able to export as much coal to China as it does today, they can get rid of that coal on global markets. And there may be some impact on price, which would feed back to the Australian dollar. But if this really was the underlying motive for China making it difficult for Australian exporters, then the real, you know, I guess the elephant in the room there would be, what if China decided to restrict the issuance of visas for Chinese people coming to Australia, either for tourism purposes or for getting an education. So, you know, we currently have over a million, I think we have 120,000 Chinese tourists per month on average coming to Australia. There are over 150,000 Chinese citizens currently getting a university education in Australia. Okay. So they all require some of the largesse of the Chinese government to say, you know, we're quite happy to go there and issue a visa. If they decided to start restricting that, the economic impact on the tourism and the education sectors, which are, you know, really after iron ore and coal, the two biggest sources.
So
we think of the trade relationship between Australia and China as primarily being rocks and crops, as I like to say, which is sort of, we grow stuff and we dig iron ore and coal out of the ground and sell it to China, etc. But really, it's a much more intricate relationship there on all sorts of levels. Is there anything that would seriously interrupt the flow of trade could have some big sort of negative impact. So, you know, so there's no reason at this stage to think this is something that is going to escalate into a much broader trade dispute between effectively Australia and China at a geopolitical level, rather than us being sort of a byproduct, if you like, of the US-China trade dispute and how that's played out. But it is a concern, and it would clearly represent a significant downside risk. So, although I'm saying I think the dollar weakens, the US dollar weakens, and I think the Aussie will be in a better place from a sort of risk sentiment point of view. It's certainly one of the, maybe I should call it a black swan, not a grey rhino. I'm trying to understand what a grey rhino is now.
Oh, yeah. God,
so it's all the rage in China now, which are these sort of known big foreseeable events that aren't being priced into markets. This is out there, I'd say, as a black swan, which is, you know, something that is probably unlikely to happen. But were it to happen, could have some pretty significant
damages. I was reading this morning that the port system in question only processes like 1.8% of Australia's coal or something. So, as you say, it's not significant in its magnitude. I mean, 1.8% is not nothing. It hurts at the margin. But at a wider level, if it's indicative of where things are going, you can see why people are quite anxious about that. And the the tourism and education likely to affect more people within the economy, I guess. So the economy more
collectively,
broader.
Yes, yeah. In terms of the number of people employed in those sectors, for example. So again, as I say, it's not clearly the tourism industry here, and also the tertiary education sector.
Flow onto housing, right, and various other.
Well, that's the other risk is that we've clearly seen in the NAB quarterly residential property survey shows this very clearly that the proportion of foreign buyers, not just Chinese, but foreign investor participation in the Australian housing market has fallen. So if I go back to 2014-15, for example, foreign investors accounted for between 15% and 20% of purchases of all new build properties in Australia. That is now down to closer to 5%, for example. Yeah. So clearly one of the demand side influences on the falls that we're seeing in house prices has been a big fall off in Chinese demand, and that's really a product of the Chinese authorities making it much harder for Chinese households to get money out of the country. So it's not a lack of desire on their part, it's really an inability and a slowing down of capital flow. So again, another indication, I think, of where what China does can have major ramifications, and certainly sort of added, I think, to the negative dynamics in the housing market.
For housing, I think many Australians felt the flows into housing were affecting prices in a big way for a couple of years, and we're going to be talking about that in a subsequent podcast. But from a currency perspective, was it enough in terms of flow to impact the currency or not really?
Well, it's clearly, I think the debate, and actually we've got, Phil Lowe, as we're recording this, Phil Lowe is up before the parliamentary committee, really, talking about housing, etc., and justifying the falls in house prices, for example. But to the extent that the Australian economy is going through something of a soft patch at the moment. And the key as far as whether it has any implications for interest rates or whether it's we start to see unemployment starting to tick up, for example. And then the fate of the housing market is important there, because we're now saying that given if we look at the rate at which new building is being approved, to housing approval rates, they're already 20% plus down on where they were. And we think that housing construction, which, construction employs over a million people in Australia, and the majority of those, or 65%, are employed in residential housing. Now, if we're going to see a 20-25% decline in new building activity 12 to 24 months in the future, potentially there are going to be a lot of people currently employed in construction who will be laid off. Now, at the macro level, that starts to mean the unemployment rate ticks up. The RBA has been very clear. That is something that would cause us to, you know, currently they're saying, we think the risks of the next move in rates being up or down is balanced, but they're making very clear that if unemployment looks like it's heading higher, they will cut rates.
Okay?
So that has some impact on the currency.
So that's where the currency impact is
to some extent. But one of the things I wanted, one of the points I wanted to get across, going back to how we think about the currency from a fair value or a modelling perspective, say interest rates are important, so are commodity prices, so are risk sentiment. But if I were to take my little model and stress it, as we say, and say, let's pretend the RBA's cash rate is 1% rather than the 1.5% that it sits today. What mechanically does that do to the fair value of the currency? It's surprisingly little. It's about a cent. Okay? One cent from where it is now. Okay? And remember, the markets are already, they're halfway towards already guessing that the RBA is going to be. So they've already got a quarter point rate cut from the RBA already priced in. So arguably the Aussie dollar today already reflects, you know, a high probability that there will be a rate cut later this year, for example. So now the market's saying we've got one priced in, and form tells you if the RBA will cut rates once, they'll probably cut rates twice, down to 1%. So there will be a little bit of impact there, but very little compared to the influence of these other factors. So for those that are, you know, saying, well, the RBA's going to have to cut rates because the economy is, you know, falling down in a hole, and rates are going to be 1% by Christmas, etc., that's not going to get the Aussie to 65 cents. Other things are going to have to be happening to get the currency down to those sorts of levels. So in our forecasts that say that we think that we might spend some time below 70 cents for the reasons that we've been talking about, I don't think it's going to, you know, it's going to drive the Aussie down to those sort of 60 cents or 50 cent levels that we had back in 1998, for example. You know, and so we can still incorporate some risk that rates will be cut without that having a meaningful impact on our outlook for the currency.
So if we look beyond the US, got Brexit to look forward to, or just observe from a distance. You know, it's always nice to see somebody else's politics almost as dysfunctional as ours. well, maybe more so. Depends on your perspective, I think. Thoughts on Brexit, any other major geopolitical issues that we need to keep an eye on that are going to impact the Aussie?
So, trade, we've talked about trade, obviously, but I think Brexit is of some global significance. Because I think, you know, if you go back, you know, 2.5 years ago to the referendum, and there was clearly a bit of a global shock at at the decision that the Brits took to want to leave. But I think within a very short space of time, it was seen very much as a little local difficulty, effectively, that wasn't going to have global ramifications.
A lot of legislative complexity.
Fast forward 2.5 years, and I don't think that's the case anymore. Because if I look at the Eurozone in particular, the economy there is clearly close to recession. We've seen that in the Labour's numbers, and policymakers are certainly saying that uncertainty about Brexit. And remember that the rest of Europe, you know, does export, you know, several hundred billion dollars worth of goods to the UK. So if the UK were to crash out at the end of March, which is when this so-called Article 50 notice period currently comes to an end, I think it would have negative implications for the broader European economy, not just for the UK, for example. So, you know, and if that means the euro is going to go down, for example. If the euro goes down, the US dollar goes up, and if the US dollar is going up, the Aussie dollar goes down. So it all sort of comes around in that sense. But to try and summarise it, I would say the risk of that so-called crash out or hard Brexit scenario is extremely low in our view. I think it's fairly clear from my observation of UK politics that there is no enthusiasm within the UK Parliament, or majority of the UK Parliament, to allow that to happen, and that we will see the control over Brexit negotiations effectively taken over by Parliament as opposed to the Prime Minister in the next couple of weeks, if the deal that she's trying to strike to sort of, or to modify the deal that she'd already struck with Brussels in order to get some satisfaction, that there would never need to be the reimposition of a hard border in the island of Ireland between the north and the south. If she's unable to sort of get enough concessions out of the EU that would satisfy the British Parliament to vote for that, then Parliament will vote on a motion, I think it's known as the Cooper Bowles or Cooper Mark II, that really says that the British Parliament will take control of the situation, and with a clear understanding that they will immediately ask for an extension of the so-called Article 50. Now that will still leave uncertainty in the air, but what it will also do is open up the possibility of a second referendum. which clearly there was something of a groundswell of opinion in favour of a second referendum. Whether that would produce a different outcome is a whole different question. My guess is that it probably would, given if people are far more informed about what it is that Brexit entails, which I think to some extent they weren't back in 2016.
Now, yeah.
There's also, looking at the demographics, this is quite serious. It's not meant to, it doesn't sound serious, but it is serious. If you think that the number of people that voted for Brexit in 2016 were very much skewed towards older people, and the numbers, but there was a big majority of younger people that wanted to stay. And I've read a piece of analysis that said, given the number of people over the age of whatever that actually are no longer on this mortal coil because they've passed on since 2016, and the number of young people who are now voting age who are more likely to vote to stay, that if you replicated the demographics of the 2016 referendum with the current demography, you'd end up with a different result. But I think other things would have to happen as well. But I read
the same piece of analysis and I was like, wow, that's astonishing.
Pretty scary. I think they said it could generate a 52 to 48% majority to stay, as opposed
it's
to
quite a swing based on.
But also, I think that together with the so-called sort of polls tracking regret, people that basically supported leaving, but now in hindsight think it was the wrong decision. So the point of all that is that if we do have this extension of Article 50, which I think is singularly the most likely outcome, then say uncertainty is still there, but the possibility of a referendum, I think we will see the British pound under some quite significant upward pressure. And if there is going to be a referendum, it's not going to take place for at least another 6 months or so. So the uncertainty factor will still be there. But if you did fast forward, it's conceivable that at the end of this year, Britain's decided that it's not going to leave. On that basis, the British pound is going to presumably go all the way back to the highs that we saw back in early 2016 before the referendum result was there. So it's important, I think, for people listening. If you're planning a holiday to the UK, my view is that sterling is going to be substantially higher than it is today in a matter of weeks or certainly a couple of months.
Right. Okay?
So I would suggest you pony up and pay and get your British pounds in now, because it could be costing you a hell of a lot more. Now against that, there's still that small risk that Britain crashes out. But I think that's we're talking about a 5% risk here. It's pretty small. The other risk that is weighing on markets is that, could the government collapse? Could there be a no-confidence motion that results in a general election? And I think what markets fear even more than a hard Brexit is the prospect of a socialist government led by Jeremy Corbyn, which, if you look at some of his policy prescriptions, really is sort of unreconstructed socialism, if you like, and markets are pretty fearful of that outcome. But again, it's a very low probability outcome. So I think if I look at the balance of risks around how Brexit plays out and what that means for the British pound against the Aussie dollar, we're very heavily biased towards thinking that. One thing I can say for sure is the pound will not be where it is today in 2 months' time, but I think the risk is that it's much more likely to be substantially higher or lower for these reasons. So that's sort of something to bear in mind for either investors in UK assets or anybody who's about to think about getting the travel money on board. That's my advice, is do it sooner rather than later.
I do feel with the pound that it is one that most people, certainly myself, we think about it from a tourism perspective. The important thing, get your pounds in.
Absolutely.
Much like the dollar, I remember being there when it was $3 to the pound, and that hurt. That was not fun at all. Ray, any other thoughts you'd like to leave our listeners with? Anything that it's really important that people understand looking at the currency over the next 6 to 12 months?
Well, hopefully I've conveyed the impression that it's really challenging this year. I really need to be paid the big bucks to try and forecast it, more so than last year.
I think
it's going to be choppy. I think we're in for fairly choppy markets as far as foreign exchange is concerned. Okay, and that means that any investor who's got any sort of international exposure, I think, is going to have to be quite nimble about how they manage that risk. So remember, if you buy shares in Apple out of Australia, you are essentially long the US dollar and short the Australian dollar. So if the US dollar is going up and the Aussie dollar is going down, that's great. But if it's going the other way, that's obviously undermining whatever you're earning on your underlying asset, for example. So I think people need to be pretty nimble in what I think will be a quite volatile environment for the next few months. So I guess that's one message to try and impart on business.
We'll come back to this conversation if things do start getting really choppy and we need a bit more guidance. We'll definitely come back to you. Ray, you and your team produce fantastic insights, and you do a fabulous job of articulating to people the risks that you see, where you see things going, all that kind of stuff, and it matters materially to a lot of our clients and customers. Where can people go to follow your work and find out more about these things?
Well, a few things I could suggest. I mean, one, we do have what's proving to be a very popular daily podcast.
You do.
Called The Morning Call, that anyone can subscribe to, either via SoundCloud or via iTunes, for example, The Morning Call. Some of our written research we do make available on sort of the publicly accessible NAB website. So that we write a daily report sort of summarising what's gone on overnight, what our outlook is for the day. There's an Australian Markets Weekly there, which is much more what's happening in the Australian economy and in financial markets. And you can also get The Morning Call as well on that site. So that's available at, I think it's business.nab.com.au. So if you go to the Business Insights section there, quite a lot of research is accessible. So that's a couple of suggestions.
Okay, thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure.
As always, thank you so much for listening to this episode of the podcast. We hope it has been helpful in your journey to creating wealth. We always love to hear from you, so if you have any feedback or suggestions for future topics, please just email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au. I'm Gemma Dale. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you for listening to Your Wealth with Gemma Dale. To stay up to date, please subscribe to this podcast series or email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au.
Please note that any advice provided in this podcast has been prepared without taking into account your objectives, financial circumstances, or needs. Before acting, you should consider the appropriateness of the information. To find out more, please visit nab.com.au.